It's 9 o'clock on a Thursday night. It is time for the Earth First Update, all the environmental news you can use. Let's start off with announcements this week. The California Native Plant Society, Santa Cruz County Chapter of the Habitat Restoration Team, will be having a restoration this Saturday, November 20th, from 10 a.m. to 1 p.m. at Twin Lakes State Park. We have had a lot of interest about this project. I'm anticipating a large group of folks and getting a lot done. We will continue our work on removal of invasive non-native English ivy from the understory of the Coast Live Oaks. The park is adjacent to Swan Lake, and it's a good location for bird watching with double-crested cormorants, dabbling and diving ducks, a host of coots, and a variety of grebes, herons, and gulls. Join us at this special oak woodland park with surrounding coastal prairie grasslands. See you there. How do you get there? Well, thing to do is basically get yourself to the Simpkins Family Swim Center at 979 17th Avenue. You can get there a lot of different ways, but it's just a little south of Bromer on 17th Avenue. Just go across the railroad tracks and make an immediate turn into the Simpkins Family Swim Center. Drive all the way back to the far end of the parking lot, and they will meet you back there, and they will get into Twin Lakes State Park from there. Once again, it's this Saturday, November 20th, from 10 a.m. to 1 p.m. at Twin Lakes State Park. The Habitat Restoration Team is an all-volunteer group working to restore native habitat in the parks and protected lands in Santa Cruz County. Their program provides an opportunity for people to learn about the natural systems that surround them while helping to restore special and wild places. No prior work experience is necessary. Just show up at the park. They welcome individual volunteers from 8 to 80. Just wear comfortable layered clothing, bring something to drink. You might want to have an umbrella. They do work rain or shine, but if things get particularly unpleasant, they call it a day. Tools are provided. Just bring gloves and some water to drink. If you want further information, contact their program leader, Linda. Her number, 831-462-4041. That's 462-4041. You could give her an email at redwoodrn, that's REDWDRN, at pacbell.net, or visit their website at www.cruzcnps.org, that's CRUZCNPS.org. And have fun out there. It might be a little wet. Here's the Buffalo Field Campaign's update from the field. The annual migration of wild bison advocates is in full swing as people converge from the four directions upon the Buffalo Field Campaign headquarters near West Yellowstone, Montana. For a decade and a half, Buffalo Field Campaign volunteer patrols have been documenting the management of America's last wild bison in the field and working to protect the bison and their habitat. Our 2010-2011 field season gets underway this week. Nearly a foot of snow has fallen here just outside of Yellowstone's western boundary with hinting of heavy weather. That's the stuff that's coming in. And a challenging time for migrating bison. Winter herself is a formidable enough challenger, yet wild buffalo face a far greater danger from a cattle industry-driven management plan designed to keep Montana's landscape bereft of wild bison through grazing, shooting, capture, and slaughter. In addition to the management plan, the annual Montana Bison Hunt began November 15th and will continue through February 15th. It is the only hunt of an ecologically extinct species and one of the longest-running hunts of any wildlife species in the state. As of this writing, there are no wild bison in Montana, and Buffalo Field Campaign patrols haven't observed any approaching the ecologically meaningless Yellowstone-Montana border. Wild bison are not allowed year-round access to their habitat in Montana, and they are chased from or killed upon their native ground by the hundreds every spring. As if the management plan were bad enough on its own, any buffalo that migrate into Montana prior to February 15th will be shot by hunters. Under the unique bison hunting regulations, the more buffalo that migrate into the state, the more tags Montana's Department of Fish, Wildlife, and Parks will issue to kill them. Fish, Wildlife, and Parks hunt regulations boldly state that one of the main objectives of the hunt is to control bison in Montana to address the scientifically unfounded and wildly exaggerated fears of Montana's livestock industry that native bison threaten cattle with the disease brucellosis. Wild bison have never transmitted this disease, which cattle originally carried to the Americas, to livestock. Elk, believed to have transmitted brucellosis to cattle, are allowed to enter and exit Montana year-round without being subject, as the buffalo are, to intrusive government actions. But this is about to change. Under pressure from the livestock industry, Montana recently announced plans to capture and test up to 500 cow elk for brucellosis exposure. Exposure is no indicator of infection, and elk and bison often develop resistance to the disease. Unlike bison, who are killed when they are tested positive, none of the captured elk will be sent to slaughter regardless of the test results. Yet, this is yet one more contradiction belying Montana's anti-buffalo prejudice. The Buffalo Field Campaign believes that efforts to prevent the spread of wild... Buffalo Field Campaign believes that efforts to prevent the spread of livestock diseases, including brucellosis, should be directed at livestock. Anyone familiar with the history of the American West will recognize the slaughter and harassment of Yellowstone bison elk as the latest battles in a century-old range war. Brucellosis is used by the livestock industry to sway public opinion against wild bison and now elk to control their movements and to keep their habitat open to cattle. As snow piles up outside the Buffalo Field Campaign cabin, we are making ready for another winter, our 14th in the field, as Montana and the federal government prepare to waste our tax dollars to harass and kill native elk and bison. We draw strength and prepare to protect the bison and elk in the field, the courts, the legislatures, and the media. But we can't do it without you. Join the Buffalo Field Campaign on the front lines this season. Support our work. Contact your members of Congress, the media, and everyone you know to urge their help for America's last wild buffalo. You can send your donation to the Buffalo Field Campaign at P.O. Box 957, West Yellowstone, Montana, the zip 59758. And I suggest that whatever you do, you visit their webpage at www.buffalofieldcampaign.org. Find out what they need and find out what it takes to become a volunteer. If you have any questions, give them a call. Their number, 406-646-0070. That's 406-646-0070. And do remember that the Buffalo Field Campaign is the only group working in the field every day in defense of the last wild buffalo in the United States. And here's a little something. Hey there, Santa Cruz Earth First. I need your help. Lately, I've been getting into the climate change debate like I needed that headache. You know, it's the same old shit. We have a do-nothing government, so I've come up with a very big idea. I want to see something big that gets the government moving big on this, big and fast. How about this? We shut down Interstate 70. You heard me right. Shut down Interstate 70. We shut it down between the east and west borders of Kansas and everything in between. We shut it down until the government comes up with legislation that will actually do something, and something big. It'll be a camp out on America's greatest highway. Look at it this way. Given the slow pace and minimal scope of current legislation, the something big that will happen is climate change itself. So, we beat it to the punch with this I-70 idea. What do you say? We need about 10 to 20 million people, though. How do we do that? Well, that's what this public service announcement is all about. If you want to help out Danny with his shutdown I-70 idea, send your information to Danny at Dannyheim, D-A-N-N-Y-H-E-I-M, at hotmail.com, and tell him you want to sit on I-70. How's that for an idea? And sustainable wood may still cause some damage in this story by Kate Revelius. Kate Revelius, I guess that's. And she's with Environmental Research Web. New research suggests that the impact of sustainable wood on soil and carbon has been overlooked. Lisa Kelman of the Environmental Sciences Research Center at St. Francis Xavier University, Canada, and her team have been investigating the impact that forest harvesting has on the underlying soil. It seems that the damage goes deeper than previously thought and lasts much longer than traditionally assumed. When we buy a new wardrobe made from sustainably sourced wood, we tend to assume that the trees that were harvested to make the product were replaced by new trees, which continue to mop up carbon dioxide from the atmosphere and stabilize carbon in the soil. The Forest Stewardship Council, for example, one of the largest and most well-known certification schemes in the United Kingdom, says that its label, quote, guarantees that trees are harvested, are replaced, or allowed to regenerate naturally, unquote. However, Kelman's research shows that simply planting a new tree isn't always enough to negate the damage of cutting down an old one. She has been studying carbon and nitrogen storage in the soil at a red spruce forest in Nova Scotia, Canada. The red spruce has been harvested in a similar manner since the 1940s, but the forest also contains an area of virgin old-growth trees, providing an ideal reference point. Kelman and colleagues have studied soil profiles down to a depth of 50 centimeters, that's about 18 inches, at five different sites across the forest. Each site was similar in all aspects apart from the age of the trees, which range from freshly planted one-year-olds to ancient trees older than 125 years. Researchers found that storage of carbon in the soil reached a minimum approximately 30 years after harvesting, at which point carbon was around 50% of its original level. That storage didn't bounce back to its pre-cut level until approximately 100 years after harvesting. What's more, the study revealed that the greatest losses occurred at a depth of 20 centimeters in the soil, a region deeper than most previous studies of soil carbon storage have examined. Worryingly, the study also showed a similar picture for soil nitrogen, but with even longer recovery times. So what does this all mean for sustainably sourced wood? According to Kelman, many current certification schemes may not be allowing enough time for the woodland to regenerate. My research suggests that long rotation times on the order of 80 to 100 years are critical for sustainably managing forests and ensuring that carbon lost to the atmosphere is ultimately returned to the soil, she told Environmental Research Web. Shortening harvest rotation times have the potential to make a resource unsustainable and to contribute to the rise in atmospheric greenhouse gases. Ultimately, we may have to curb our appetite for new wood products and become a bit more patient about waiting for trees to grow. And here's a plea to save the Mojave Desert from mass industrialization. 17,000 cultural sites, including petroglyphs and extremely large earth drawings known as geoglyphs in Southern California, may soon be destroyed thanks to Chevron, Solar Millennium, Florida Power and Light, NextEra, and various other companies. Now held in trust by the Bureau of Land Mismanagement, these sacred sites are being cast aside so these companies can build massive solar projects under a, quote, fast-tracked process, unquote, put in place by the American Recovery and Reinvestment Act program. ARRA guarantees government tax credits and rebates in the amount of hundreds of millions of dollars to companies that can put shovel to dirt before the end of 2010, said Robert Lundahl, director of the upcoming documentary film Solar Gold. For just one of the projects, Blythe Solar, a partnership of Chevron and the German firm Solar Millennium, will grade and level 9,500 acres of desert in an area near the Blythe giant intaglios. These are extremely large geoglyphs, images created on the surface of the earth representing man, woman, creator, the seed, and the Trinity in the Ute Aztecan cosmological view. In this excerpt of Solar Gold, Alfredo Acosta Figueroa, an elder, tribal monitor, and historian from the Chemehueve peoples, describes the importance of these sacred intaglios, how they were made, and what they mean to the indigenous people. Figueroa also offers a humble suggestion on how they can be protected. Cultural sites aren't the only thing at risk. Dr. Jim Andre, director of the Granite Mountains Desert Research Institute, in a recent interview with Lundahl, stated that these new solar projects could severely impact the environment, so much so that he suggests the possibility of ecosystem collapse. The scale of an impact has never occurred before, states Andre. Once it reached about 250 proposed projects from 5 to 25,000 acres each, totaling 2 million acres just for California, when you consider the importance of these ecosystems to provide corridors for species to move as climate changes, whether it's human-caused damage or just the natural course of variation in climate change, you've really done the entire ecosystem at that scale. You've really done in the entire ecosystem at that scale. Rather than be smart from the start by utilizing ecologically degraded sites first, a reckless and scientifically unmerited decision has been made instead to race into our most pristine desert and obliterate some of the most botanically significant lands in California. The project hemorrhages at the very heart of the biologically rich eastern Mojave Desert, where plant diversity rivals that of the primeval coastal redwood forests of the Pacific Northwest, an area treasured by scientists throughout the world for its unparalleled pristine quality among deserts and recognized as one of the last functional ecosystems left on planet Earth. The project relies on mitigation concepts with no scientific foundation and on statements of overriding consideration that sets a very low bar for how our generation chooses to transform how we generate energy while cohabitating the planet. Indeed, we have hastened the very ecological destruction for which the ISEGS project is meant to mitigate. Much like the Eastern Mojave Desert, Ivanpah Valley lies at the hub of a floristic frontier where botanists continue to discover new species to science every year. With as many as 10% of the plant species yet to be described, we measure the cost of destroying this desert by extinction not only to known species, but to those we will never know. As for the film, Lundahl says, it will be a historical account of this moment in history when society makes a critical decision whether renewable energy development comes at the price of the obliteration of the records of the Mojave Desert cultures, which by virtue of their longevity on the land were examples of the sustainability our nations and communities now seek. But who knows if the monument will ever be recorded on film. Lundahl says they need to raise a minimum of $15,000 from now until December 15th to document endangered geoglyphs, interview BLM managers and hold them to account, dispute BLM contentions that the Kokopili geoglyph and others are of recent origins by interviewing tribal elders and traditional chiefs. This material will be used in the film Solar Gold, being produced for public television, he continues. In the meantime, sections will be posted on the web and distributed via social media, blogs, and partner websites to support oppositions to the projects. And if you'd like more information, go to the following website, www.basinandrangewatch.org. That's basinandrangewatch.org. And there's a grim outlook for grizzlies in the Yellowstone Basin in this story by Julie Cart of the Los Angeles Times. With milder winters affecting their food and hibernation habits, they're forced into a meat-dependent diet, putting them at odds with humans and livestock. They could end up as despised as wolves. It's been a bad year for grizzly bears, and if forecasts prove correct, it's only going to get worse. The tally of grizzly deaths in the states bordering the greater Yellowstone region is fast approaching the worst on record, and that's before the numbers come in from the current hunting season, a time when accidental grizzly shootings are traditionally high. Here in Wyoming, more bears are killed this year than ever, including a bear shot by a hunter last week. A number of complex factors are believed to be working against grizzlies, including climate change. Milder winters have allowed bark beetles to decimate the white bark pine, whose nuts are a critical food source for grizzlies. Meanwhile, there has been a slight seasonal shift for plants that grizzlies rely on when they prepare to hibernate and when they emerge in the spring, changing the creature's denning habits. The result, some biologists say, is that bears accustomed to feasting on berries and nuts in remote alpine areas are being pushed into a more meat-dependent diet that puts them on a collision course with other dominant regional omnivore, humans. A grizzly is a top-level carnivore. At times, he will act like one, said Chuck Neal, author of Grizzlies in the Mist, who lost a botanist friend to a grizzly attack this year. People are a readily available source of high-quality protein. We eat too much and exercise too little. We're like a hot dog on two legs. Chris Servine, a grizzly researcher for the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service, downplays the role of white bark pine loss, noting that grizzlies are highly adaptive and don't specialize on white bark pines. It's easier to describe what they don't eat than what they do, Servine said. Still, the evidence is not encouraging for the grizzly, which was placed on the endangered species list in 1975. 2 years ago, 52 grizzlies died from human causes in the Yellowstone area. As of the end of October, 48 bears have been killed this year. The phenomenon is repeated with other bear species across the region from New Mexico to the Canadian border. Wildlife agencies are reporting hungry black and brown bears roaming into backyards to get at dog food, ransacking campgrounds, challenging elk and deer hunters for their kills. There's another chilling footnote to 2010. For the first time anyone can remember, grizzlies attacked and killed two people. In June, Neil's friend, the botanist, was alone when he stumbled upon a nuisance bear west of Cody, Wyoming, just as it was coming out of anesthesia after being relocated by wildlife officials. In July, near Cook City, Montana, an undernourished sow with three cubs stalked a group of sleeping campers over several hours, attacking two people before killing one man. Parts of the victim were found in the sow's stomach. Maulings of humans are also up around the Rockies, occurring at twice the yearly average in Wyoming, and grizzlies in record numbers are being euthanized by wildlife managers because of persistent run-ins with people, including hunting livestock. In 2008, we had a huge pileup of dead bears. This year could get to that, said Louisa Wilcox, who studies bears for the Natural Resources Defense Council. These conflicts should be seen as warning signs, flashing yellow lights. As they continue to interact with humans and harass and kill livestock, bears risk earning the type of scorn heaped on wolves in the region, which are viewed less as an emblematic creature of the West and more as varmints that plague the landscape. Public tolerance is starting to wane somewhat, said Mark Brusino, bear management supervisor for Wyoming's Department of Game and Fish. You can look at the mountains and know there are grizzly bears there. That sits pretty good with people, but when you look in your kid's 4-H facility and bears have ruined the place, that changes things. People in Wyoming think they have had enough with bears. If a shift in public perception drives changes in policy, grizzly bears could be legally hunted in the lower 48 for the first time in nearly four decades. To Brusino, it's simply wise game management to harvest animals and might be better for the bears. Right now, there's no value on bears, he said. If people are allowed to compete for a limited number of hunting licenses, people will start to ascribe more value to bears. The animals may be a victim of the success of conservation efforts. In 2007, the species was considered to have recovered enough to be taken off the endangered species list, but a court overturned that decision last year and returned the bears to threatened status, a decision the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service is appealing. Wildlife officials meeting last week in Montana concluded the region's grizzly population is about 600, nearly three times the 1975 numbers. Some concluded that the increased bear conflict signal what the region has reached a carrying capacity for grizzlies. The bucket is getting full, said Chuck Schwartz, who heads the Federal Interagency Grizzly Bear Study Team. You have to think about how many bears we should have in this ecosystem. The greatest single predictor for conflict is the number of bears. With more bears and more people stuffed into the 22,000 square miles of bear habitat, something has to give, and no one here has a simple answer. Grizzlies don't realize that setting up in a subdivision is a bad thing, Schwartz said. They perceive it as suitable habitat, food, space, no competition. What they don't realize is there's a lot of people. You can expect to have conflict and bear mortalities. It's a given when bears and people live in the same area. In order to adapt to other food sources, they must be able to range far afield, author Neil says. It will continue to be this way until we allow the bears to expand their range. Right now, we're maintaining an open zoo. Excuse me. The two bear attacks that resulted in human fatalities shocked experts who were at a loss, especially to explain the predatory behavior of the sow and her three cubs. But an investigative report that included a necropsy of the female bear may have provided the answer. The bears were simply hungry. In spare clinical terms, the report describes the mother bear as thin and undernourished. Her three offspring were likewise skinny. Nutritionally stressed is the term used. The female's stomach content showed she had not eaten pine nuts nor much of anything else before the attack. Her intestines were ravaged by parasites. She may not have been able to provide enough milk for her cubs. After the attack, authorities captured the four bears near the site, surmising that the family was resting before returning to its kill. The mother was euthanized and the three cubs were taken to a zoo in Bozeman, where they were fed meat and fruit, which they readily ate. And here's the news about the Rogue River. Rogue dam removal progresses. And this story by Scott Learn of the Oregonian. Mile 126 of the Rogue River features white-topped riffles, rushing water, big patches of clean gravel just under the surface, and a smattering of Chinook salmon carcasses, a clear signal that the fish are spawning here. That's remarkable because as of August, this water was slack and deep, backed up behind the 1904 Gold Ray Dam, and far better suited to non-native bass than the king of Northwest rivers. Bob Hunter of Waterwatch of Oregon has spent 25 years pushing dam removal on the Rogue. He anchors his shop-worn aluminum fishing boat near a gravel bar upstream of the former dam, the best place to spot flopping salmon. After more than a century under restraint, the Rogue hasn't settled down yet, he said. It'll take years to restore, but immediately we've got a river again, Hunter says. It's just like turning a switch. This story has been repeated in rapid succession on the Rogue, Oregon's second leading salmon stream after the Columbia. In just 3 years, four dams have been breached in the Rogue Basin. Three of the dams, Gold Ray, Savage Rapids, and Gold Hill, bottle up the Rogue's main stem. Another blocked fish from Elk Creek, a key coho salmon tributary farther upstream on the Rogue. For the first time in 106 years, the Rogue River now runs free for 157 miles from the William L. Jess Dam at Lost Creek Lake to the Pacific Ocean at Gold Beach. Nationwide, four other rivers have seen dams topple at a similar pace, the conservation group American Rivers says. The Baraboo in Wisconsin, the Ashuelot in New Hampshire, and the Patapsco in Maryland, and the Eel in Massachusetts. On the West Coast, the Rogue reigns. Oregon fish biologists are already seeing the payoff. Earlier this month, they found 31 reds or salmon nests in the 1.3 miles of river once covered by the reservoir behind Gold Ray. In the former reservoir pool above Savage Rapids Dam, removed last year, they spotted 63 reds. Dan Van Dyke, Rogue District fish biologist for the Oregon Department of Fish and Wildlife, said he's pleased. The counts of difficult-to-spot reds are almost certainly a minimum, but he's not surprised. We're getting habitat that favors species native to the river, Van Dyke says. If you love the Rogue, you have a lot of reason to be excited for the future. Dams are far from an endangered species. Depending on what count you track, the U.S. has at least 79,000 relatively large dams, many providing some combination of hydropower, flood control, irrigation, or drinking water storage. American Rivers counts about 800 dams removed, less than 1%, most in the last 50 years. But like U.S. bridges and sewer systems, dams are aging and falling below modern safety standards. Fixing them up costs a lot of money, particularly when fish passage upgrades are required by the Endangered Species Act. And the pace of removal has picked up. Since 1999, nearly 400 dams have come down. That year, the Edwards Dam on Maine's Kennebec River was the first removed primarily for environmental reasons, American Rivers said. Since then, for all kinds of reasons, public safety, economics, flooding, wildlife, we have seen scores of communities removing dams, said A.B. Kober, the group's spokesperson. In the world of dam removal, Gold Ray came down at a lightning pace in just 4 years. Federal stimulus money and money from Oregon's Watershed Enhancement Board helped. So did the endangered species listing of coastal coho in 1997, providing legal leverage to demolish fish-blocking dams. The 38-foot-high dam generated electricity for Pacific Power until 1972. The utility transferred ownership to Jackson County, where it became a maintenance and safety liability. Engineers estimated it would take nearly $70 million to upgrade it, versus the $5.6 million it took to take it out. Downriver, the Savage Rapids Dam, in contrast, took 21 years to remove, including lawsuits, battles with the legislature, and opposition from the Grants Pass Irrigation District. The district, which supplies 6,700 acres with water, eventually concluded that the cost to repair the dam built in 1921 and improve fish passage exceeded the expense to demolish the dam and install new irrigation pumps and screens to keep out juvenile fish. Federal and state agencies picked up most of the $40 million cost, but the project forced the district to use electricity to pump water for the first time, increasing irrigation bills. Today, feelings about dam removal among the district patrons are really a mixed bag, says General Manager Dan Shepard. With the younger to middle-aged people, it doesn't seem to be that big of an issue, Shepard says, but some of the people who have lived here longer, they still view it as Big Brother coming in. Savage Rapids included fish ladders to allow returning salmon and steelhead to pass, but it was considered the Rogue's number one fish killer. Gold ray was number 5 on Oregon's 2006 list of obstacles to migrating fish. Demolishing dams removes those barriers, frees up new spawning grounds, and depending on what's built around it, allows rivers to wander, providing slower water refuges in winter. The reservoirs behind dams also heat up in the summer, bad news for salmon and steelhead, both of which are cold water fish. There are drawbacks, too. Slow-moving reservoirs can provide good wetlands, 2 sloughs backed up behind Gold Ray. Bass fishing and duck hunting will drop there. Decades of sediment accumulated behind dams surges out when they're removed, hampering salmon spawning downstream and clogging water intakes. Fish biologists say it's increasingly clear that those effects are temporary. In my opinion, the benefits to the ecology of the river far outweigh the temporary costs, said Van Dyke of the Oregon Department of Fish and Wildlife. On a float through the newly opened river section, Hunter, a 56-year-old avid fly fisherman as well as Water Watch's attorney, accentuates the positive. Longer trips for river guides, more salmon and steelhead for fishermen, newly accessible rapids on one of Oregon's wildest rivers. The Rogue generates 15% of Oregon's wild Chinook and steelhead, according to estimates from the Wild Salmon Center. If Oregon has a chance of saving wild runs, Hunter says the Rogue River is one of our best bets. Going forward, the focus will be on restoration. The dam at Lost Creek Lake is here to stay, Hunter says. Next year, the new riverbank will be planted with bigleaf maples, willows, dogwoods, and alder, replacing blackberry bushes that coat the banks now. Some 500 acres of land around the former Gold Ray Dam are in public hands, giving the river room to reclaim its boundaries and create new channels, gravel bars, and spawning areas. We're resetting the clock on the Rogue, Hunter says, kind of like going back in time. Well, speaking of time, that's all the time we have for the Earth First update for this week. Yep. That's it. We're out of time. We'd like to invite you to tune into the Earth First update again next Thursday evening at 9 o'clock or to download it on the internet. If you'd like to do that, either listen or download a copy of this program from the internet, please go to the following website, www.h2opodcast.com. That's h2opodcast.com. When you get there, click on Earth and then select Earth First Radio. And we'd like to thank the folks at h2opodcast.com for recording and providing archives for our listeners. The Earth First Update is a production of Earth First Radio and is produced in the studios of Free Radio Santa Cruz. I want to thank you for listening and do tune in again next week, Thursday evening at 9 o'clock, for another Earth First Update.